So I had no idea.
There we go.
We'll call the Committee on Higher Education, Innovation, and Workforce Development to order. And we're going to, agenda today, we're going to carry over Senate Bill 493. I hear there's an amendment coming, so we're going to wait for that. And I believe we'll meet on Friday, but we'll talk about that later. In the meantime, we will have an open informational hearing on longitudinal database upgrade. So we'll have an open the informational hearing. I think Peter Trumbaugh and Alex Pettit. Welcome.
Good morning, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Peter Tromba, and I'm the Policy and Research Director at the Oregon Education Investment Board.
And for the record, my name is Alex Pettit. I'm the Chief Information Officer for the State of Oregon.
Good morning.
So for this morning, we have a brief presentation regarding the state longitudinal data system. And what I've found in presenting this to other audiences is often the most valuable part of the presentation is the Q&A. So both Alex Pettit and I are available for questions once we've gotten through the presentation. First off, just a note on the acronym at the very top of this, OEIB, obviously is Oregon Education Investment Board. P through 20 is an acronym we use a lot to refer to the idea of preschool all the way through post-secondary. And originally, the design and the call for this database called it P through 20. What's interesting is that as we've begun to work with existing data systems in Oregon, another element that obviously this committee is very interested in is workforce. That's another element of the data. So it's possible somewhere else on this slide, or it's possible I might slip and say P through 20W, and that's just an acronym to refer to the fact that workforce data is also part of this system. As I mentioned before, this data system was called in statute in 2011 when the OEIB was created. And we'll talk in some detail about timeline and what's been done and what hasn't been done, but I want to call out that it is in statute, and the current Senate Bill 215, which has to do with the OEIB sunset and changes at the OEIB moving forward, recapitulates the need for this data system, and that legislation actually has some slightly different language regarding the data system, but with regard to the intent of it, it's preserved from what was originally passed in 2011. One thing that's critical to understand about this data system that distinguishes it from many other types of data systems is the fact that it's at the student level. And this is a very, very important component to the system that actually gives it some unique power to be able to do data and analysis. Many, many data sets that we look at when we look at Oregon data or national data is aggregated data. So all of the students in a school are aggregated up when we look at a school report card. The same is true of districts in the state often. One thing about this database that's so important is having that student-level data, which, as I'll describe in a couple of minutes, allows you to do some pretty powerful analyses. And the last part is why. Why are we creating this? And I'll go into some detail, but just generally, the primary purpose is to better understand Oregon educational outcomes, improve our practices, and improve the policies that we recommend, both policies that lead to fiscal investments and just general policies that change practices. This diagram, I don't expect you to be able to read it on the screen, but I just want to refer to it right now in the beginning, and it's going to be something that Alex Pettit would give more detailed information about should you have questions about it. But this is a diagram of the process that we use in the state of Oregon to implement software projects. And as I go through our presentation, I'm going to talk about accomplishments and risks and milestones that we've hit. And all of that is in a context of this process, which is called the stage gate process. And the way I generally understand it as a user of it or a customer of it is that we go through each stage of a project, minimizing the amount of risk and clarifying exactly what we're doing and how much it's going to cost. And we don't move through a staged gate and get an additional allocation of resource and make an additional step in the process until we've answered critical questions. And the purpose of that, really, I think, from a user of it, is to fail early and succeed late versus have a lot of successes in the beginning and a big failure at the end. And we've seen some of our own failures early, to be honest with you. But I'm optimistic that what it means is that the final product is going to be rock solid and really what we need as a state. So I referenced key accomplishments. I'd like to go over them first. The initial business case that OEIB created in the short session last February was a rewrite from the original conceptualization of the business case that came with our first chief education officer, Dr. Rudy Crew. And actually what we produced last February was a much reduced project that was lower cost and lower risk. That enabled us to get through the first stage gate on that previous diagram. After going through that stage gate, we hired an independent quality assurance company, a vendor that Oregon contracted with, who has no stake in the game either way. And they did this extensive review process of all of the documents, assumptions that we'd made, and also compared the proposed work in Oregon to work going on in other states. And the result of that risk assessment, or quality and risk assessment, was some pretty substantial changes in that original business case. Some of the changes were in scope of the project to limit the scope of it, and some of it clarified some risks that we had not identified as a project team that we had to account for. One result of that QA process quality assessment was to create a phased implementation plan. I can talk about that a little bit, but it basically meant that we were trying to do too many things all at the same time, which led us to not get enough traction in what we needed to do. So we created a phased plan, which I'll discuss. As I mentioned before, it resulted in a revised business case. Another accomplishment of the project that in many ways is the most important accomplishment, it's something that Alex has been a huge proponent of, is a governance plan. This data system, as I'll describe in a second, takes data from all over the state, takes data from higher ed, K-12, workforce. And this is not the first attempt in Oregon to create a longitudinal data system. And every other time we've tried to do it in the state, we failed in one way or the other. And in analyzing that, when I first got up to the state and started interviewing a lot of folks involved, the key failure almost always was not money, and it wasn't software, and it wasn't knowledge, and it wasn't will. It was governance. It was the ability to make a decision when you have two agencies that are parallel to each other, of equal standing, who don't agree about an issue of data governance or ownership or use. If you don't have a method to break a tie, you get stuck. And actually, the examples of that, not just in Oregon, but across the country, are legion. And one serious accomplishment that has been made is we have a data governance structure that the ODE and the HEC and the OEIB have signed into. And it puts the OEIB chief education officer in the position of tiebreaker. And my understanding of Senate Bill 215 is that that would still be true moving forward.
I have a question.
Would it be okay to ask a question now, because it's just driving me crazy?
Absolutely.
How long has this process been in place, and does it apply just to OEIB, or is it a statewide, the stage gate system, is it a statewide system?
Chairman Gallegos, Representative Reardon, thank you for the question. I'm Alex Pettit again. The longitudinal data system was the first system that came for approval back in February of 2014. And it was at that time that I had only been here for a month at that point, that I had identified that we did not have what's commonly called a systems development life cycle, or SDLC for want of another acronym. I had used a similar process in my previous job as Chief Information Officer for the state of Oklahoma, and with their P20 system, it was going through a similar trajectory, a similar process. So we instantiated that, I guess, really in March of 2014. We have worked to develop those. It's a very busy slide, but the examples are the templates for those. And so we've been doing this for, what would that be, about a little over a year, I guess.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. I can relax now.
Sure. More questions. Representative Nierman has sat through several presentations of it. He's probably well-versed in it by now. So.
Ask him.
Another key accomplishment is that the OEIB, or the Chief Education Office, as it may be called in the future, is receiving all of the hardware and software that was in the previous statewide longitudinal data project, which resided at ODE, called Project Alder. So that is nice. That's a resource that we have to actually put the system on. It's going to be at no cost to the state. A significant accomplishment with regard to our partners is that we have a data dictionary, which is going to be the foundation of all the work that we do going forward, identifying exactly what data we're collecting. And we don't have computers yet at OEIB to take this data. We won't until July 1, but we've done a dry run where we've actually met with the partners and enacted the data run, but kind of in a pretend fashion, but we figured out what data elements are available and for how many years we have good data on each of these elements. Second from the bottom there, but a huge topic and issue is, as most of you know, because it's been a topic this session, okay, has to do with student data privacy. There's pending legislation regarding limits to the use of student data for a variety of reasons. Some of those reasons directly influence the state use of student data. And as a matter of fact, some of the data privacy legislation would have ended a project like this. Other elements of the data privacy legislation provides critical safeguards to students. It's been an important conversation, but to some extent it's been a delay in some ways with the process. So we see it as an accomplishment that we're moving forward with legislation, but it's become a necessary precondition that we answer the questions about what Oregon legislation will pass regarding data privacy. And then finally, another key accomplishment at the OEIB is we've been developing research capacity to use longitudinal data. And we've been doing that with existing longitudinal databases that we have in Oregon, which I'll show in a couple of minutes. But it's not trivial to develop the ability to understand. It's one thing to have a data set. It's another thing to be able to answer powerful questions that relate to policy. So we've been developing that capacity. The key project risks at this point, first and foremost, is that this project involves multiple agencies, as I referred to before. And one example of how, in both sort of sectors of education, this is complicated. At the K-12 side or the P-12 side, Oregon Department of Ed has had a data system and a data department for years, and they've got things pretty locked down. But they've recently added the Early Learning Division, and the Early Learning Division is just emerging in terms of the data that it collects about early learning providers and what data it might collect, because it collects essentially little or no data on individual students. So the ODE is in the process of working with its new division to incorporate early learning data. So they're a moving target in terms of a partner. It's good that data is being included, but it's tricky to work with. At the higher ed level, which you're more familiar with, I assume, the same thing is true. The HEC is incorporating data from the Chancellor's Office, which for years and years had four-year data, and the community colleges, which have had data from its institutions, and databases like scholarships or GED or others. So our partners are themselves in the midst of different IT projects that affect our project, and that's really a risk for us. Second thing is the data availability from the ODE and HEC, and that to a large degree has been answered by our dry run, but to be honest, until the first time we actually get a data transfer and verify the veracity of the data and the accuracy of it, we still consider it a project risk until we actually do it for real. Third risk I referenced before is concerns about privacy. And then the last project risk, and it's pretty significant, and actually that bubble at the bottom is supposed to be a little bit bigger, is OEIB capacity. OEIB is a teeny agency. I don't know if we're the smallest, but we're probably one of the smallest. We have 15 people. The staff for this project is, as compared to other agencies doing similar broad scope projects, really lean and mean. We've only just added a project director to the project about a month ago and have really needed that. So that's been an ongoing project risk that is something something that we've accomplished really by partnering with other agencies to make it work, but it still remains a concern is our capacity to do all the work required to make it through the state processes and then begin implementation. Governance, I referenced before, is really, really a critical one. This is a slide I'm proud of because it's something that's in place. From the top, we have that Data Governance Committee. It meets quarterly or on an ad hoc basis when needed to make key decisions about data use. That Data Governance Committee also has some signed agreements between the agencies. We have a monthly steering committee that meets that includes stakeholders from schools, colleges, and universities, also from agencies. And they review all the key project decisions and project progress. And then we have project team that meets all the time, essentially, at least weekly, sometimes more frequently. And then along on the side is something that is critical, which is that we have essentially every other week, sometimes less frequently, we have a meeting with the CIO's office, with the Department of Administrative Services, and with Legislative Fiscal. And that group really is working as a partner with us each step of the way to make sure that there's no surprises at the end when we're actually asking for money to implement. And also one function of that group is to be a critical listener as we move forward and a critic when we're not able to articulate sufficiently what it is we're trying to do. So what exactly is this database? Well, if you start out at what we already have, I think it's best you can see what we're trying to build. So at the very top of this, these are the four key agencies right now that have longitudinal databases who are going to supply OEIB. Oregon Department of Education has, it says multiple sources. Their key database is called SCODS. That's a funny acronym that just says Student-Centered Operational Data System. But they've got information on K-12 students and a wealth of it. Community College and Workforce Development has a data system. It's known either as D4A or OCCURS. The Oregon University System has a data system called SCARF. And then the Oregon Employment Department has a data system called PRISM. The idea is that the OEIB database would collect submissions from each of these data sets on a periodic basis, maybe once every couple of months, maybe once a quarter, maybe once a month. We do have to establish the periodicity of that. But what's really important to understand, especially if you're thinking about privacy or security, is that these little arrows that are drawn between the top boxes and that little orange box are not live connections to live student data. As a matter of fact, the original conception of the OEIB data system that Dr. Crew presented in 2012, those lines were all live. So we were envisioning in Oregon back then a live connection all the way into schools, all the way into universities, all the way into community colleges. And there's a lot of power in a system like that, but there's a ton of risk, and it's super expensive to build. This system, because it's staged, the submissions, is much lower risk. It's not up-to-the-minute, real-time accurate what's happening in this class in Kaiser at this moment. You have a little lag. But the fact that it's not a live connection was judged to be much, much better. After the operational data store gets all that data.
Another question?
Peter, with the OUS going away, I think officially as of July 1, will there be provisions to glean or gather that data directly from the universities, or what mechanisms do you have in play, or are you thinking about to do what you're doing there without the OUS to be the clearinghouse?
Thank you for the question. Co-chairs, Representative Johnson. For the first year, the current status and the current expectation is that that OUS data will be kind of renamed HEC and be taken in and saved in exactly the same format and fashion as it's saved right now, which is in a SCARF data set, same name, same data elements, same collection process from the four-year universities. And I'm not sure if that answers your question directly. I want to say one other thing, and then we'll see if there's a follow-up. The HEC has a plan over the next year to take the data that's on SCARF and move it to the State Data Center, because right now it's at the open source lab at Oregon State, to move it to the State Data Center here in Salem and to convert it from a form that they're using right now to Microsoft SQL Server, which is sort of our standard way that we're going to have our databases. So they have to convert one database, which is Oracle, to another database. They have to physically, they have to move that data from Corvallis to Salem. And then the last thing they need to do, and honestly, I don't know what their project timeline is to complete this, but that SCARF and that occurs data, at some point over at the HEC is going to be one data system that they're going to have at the HEC. We originally envisioned that that work at the HEC would be done by now, but in fact it's not. So the way we've drawn our wireframes and what we're working on is we're assuming that the HEC does not have a single data system at this point. And once they do, we will monitor and adjust. It'll actually make things easier for us if they only have one data system. But at this point, we can't assume it because it's not there yet. And I'm not sure if that answered all of your questions, so I'll stop talking.
Well, are you envisioning a scenario then that whatever mechanisms are in place at OUS can simply be transferred to the HEC, or do we have to reinvent an entirely new level of data gathering and stuff at the HEC? I haven't heard anything regarding a request from the HEC for this sort of funding, or I don't know, you know what we're talking about here. Obviously, part of the idea behind the downsizing of OUS was to try to eliminate some of the bureaucracy, but I fear we're recreating it again. Is there a way to really cut through that, you know, more efficiently, or do you envision just having to kind of reinvent what we have at the OUS at the HEC?
Thank you for the question. Co-chairs, Rep. Johnson. My understanding is, and this might be something I want to follow up with the HEC's Director of Research and Data, Patrick Crane, but my understanding is for this year, we are basically running two systems this coming year. However, in the future, the idea is to reduce bureaucracy, reduce overhead by having one data system and a unified place for that to sit. So the final product is going to be a reduction, but the current system is going to be some parallel. Where I do know that the HEC is going to have some benefit through its combining is research staff over at OUS. Some of them are moving to higher ed, and they're going to be able to do more of data analysis and research by having one data research shop instead of having two. So as an example, one thing I've marveled at are the great reports that come out for the university system. As a high school principal, which is something I used to be, it was great to be able to get that data about the seven public universities. That kind of format and presentation of data would be something that would be presented for community colleges as well. So there's going to be some benefit from that combination right away in terms of presentation. In terms of a data perspective, we're not going to see benefits from that right off the bat.
Okay, thank you.
Next down is a real interesting thing if you're a geeky computer science person, which is how do you match data from multiple sources? And on the surface, it seems like a pretty easy thing. If you've got a record from K-12 and a record from a community college and a record from a university, you just compare names or places of birth or dates of birth or something like that, and you can do a combine. And honestly, for the first 80% or so, 70 or 80%, it's pretty easy, and states have shown this and Oregon's shown it, to determine who is who and to develop a matched record, a P through 20 W record for an Oregonian. But the other 20% or 25% are really tricky. People use different names when they enroll at community college versus the university. They may get married. They may go from Charlie to Chuck. They go, I was Pete in high school. I was Peter ever since. They may mistype in their birth date at one point or another. They may respond with a different gender. They may respond with a different racial identification. Obviously, their addresses might change. A system might have a glitch, and a name might go from Mick something to Mac something, and so on. And so there's lots of places where, by error or by design, people's identifying information starts to drift over time. And that's a common problem, and there's all kinds of common solutions to it, which involve something called identity resolution. And so the matching process at OEIB is going to involve an identity resolution method that will have advanced software do the first matching. And then there's a process where we go back to the partners. We go back to the HEC with a set of records that we say, these 25 records, we think match these 25 other records from K-12, but we're not sure. We've got a Charlie and a Chuck with about the same address, same gender, hyphenated last name, but it seems like the same person. Can you verify it? And there's a process then of verification. And that matching process then creates these really golden resources, which are these longitudinal records. And then the last step before anybody sees this data, other than confidential internal personnel, is that information is wiped of personally identifiable information. So what remains is a very valuable record. It's an individual student's pathway, so we don't aggregate and lose the individuality of it. We maintain things like gender and race and attending school and county they resided in and school they went to, but the personally identifiable information like name is removed. And once you've got that, you've got an incredible tool. And we don't have to guess about what this tool does, because as I'll say in a second, we've got a lot of examples nationwide and in Oregon about what you can do when you build something like this. We call it a policy and research tool, and our vision of it is that you are our primary customers as legislators and policymakers, as our agency folks.
Thank you, sir. What can you do with the data? It's behind. It's past data. What we need is data in front. Is that not true? And thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a military background. I'm still not sure I know what the mission of this program. We're spending a lot of money, a lot of time. What is the mission? Is it student individually directed? Is it institution directed? And when will the parent have access to it? When will the teacher have access to it? When would the superintendent have access to it? If we're just collecting data and it's not helping us, I don't know why. I mean, to help the institute or say, here's how we succeeded or failed, I don't understand. I'm sorry. I'm not that familiar with the program.
Oh, no problem at all. Thank you very much for the question, co-chairs and Rep. Wisnant. I'm actually going to skip ahead a couple of slides and probably should have had this maybe first. I wanted to end on a high note, but I'll do this now, which is what the heck do we do with it? But let me first answer the last part of your question before I go to exactly what it would do. Just to reinforce something I didn't say with much detail, my personal background is I know a lot about computers and was a computer programmer, but most of my life I've been a K-12 educator. I've also taught at higher ed. I've been a middle school, high school principal, and a tech director in two Oregon school districts, Albany and Eugene. We already have, at the district level, tremendous information available in our student information systems for teachers, principals, and superintendents. And though that might not be universally, and students and parents, and though that might not be universally available in every district, in many, many districts it is. And I can actually, if that's of something of concern or interest to the committee, talk in excruciatingly precise detail about what districts have and what they can provide to students and parents. It's a wonder of available data about individual students in a real-time fashion. What we don't have in Oregon is something that we need, which is a higher level view that allows for things like running simulations or modeling how the $8 billion plus that we put into the system, either from a regional perspective or a state perspective, is moving the needle or not on our graduation rate and other factors. So it's that lack of the statewide precision that is the target of this. So for instance, what questions will the OEIB SLDS answer? How is Oregon progressing towards its goal of 40-40-20? You've seen presentations from the HEC, from the OEIB and others about where OEIB sits right now in 40-40-20. You might wonder, well, how do we get that data? We use the census. And we try to intuit, based on people's answers to census questions, where they fall within 40-40-20. One of the census questions is, how much post-secondary education have you received? And the census asks, have you gotten associates? Have you gotten a four-year? Do you have a master's or PhD? Or do you have some college? And we have to take that and interpret that as 40-40-20. And we have a method, and OEIB uses the same one that they use over at HEC, but it's an estimate. And the census is itself an estimate, because except every 10 years, we don't ask everybody, we survey. So we don't have individual student-level data answers to this. And we don't know, also, we know a little bit about the adult population based on the census, but we cannot tell you with precision each year as a cohort of students leaves our system, either at 12th grade, community college, or the university, exactly where we are moving in real time, year to year. We sort of see a major lag in terms of our knowledge. A specific question about this is, what are the outcomes for students 5, 10, and 15 years after high school? Echo Northwest has presented some great data, both to the HEC and probably this committee as well, that show amazing information about student outcomes, like if you are white and you score a certain score in the 10th grade Oregon Standard Assessment in math versus if you're Hispanic or Latino, you're more likely to go to college and finish if you're white versus Latino. So when we have similar levels of achievement, we have different outcomes for that group. That data is critical. Again, it comes from Echo Northwest. It's very much a one moment in time snapshot, not a real time, even a 1 year up-to-date snapshot. It tells us really important things about things like the Aspire program or community college access, but it's not quite good enough. And it won't tell us enough if you folks approve critical policy interventions to help that specific problem. It won't give you sensitive and nuanced information right away about how it's affecting outcomes.
Can follow up real quick? Sir, you said your experience that teachers and principals have unlimited information. Do you have information on which students are in the ELL program, and do you have information on which students are in poverty or living in families of poverty?
Co-chairs and Representative Wisnant, sorry.
Sorry.
Promised myself I wouldn't do that.
You're not the only one.
Yeah.
So,
great question, and the answer is different on the two of them. So, English language learner status is a flag that's set within a student information system, and as a principal or a teacher, that's the kind of thing that you are able to find in a student information system, and you'll probably know that from the fact that there'll be a plan for that English language learner student, especially, there'll be a plan for that student, but it's also something you can see in your student information system. Poverty or free and reduced lunch is very different. The rules and regulations that control who's able to see that data is much, much more restrictive. As an example, in Eugene, and I think this is true of every Oregon district, the number of people who can see the poverty data is just a couple. And they're typically folks in the school lunch program, and then some folks at the district office for whom that data is important in terms of making decisions. Most principals and no teachers that I know which of their
that
students...
The people for making decisions do have that knowledge. There are some people. So, thank you. So, because the Representative Gagas and myself have been working on a bill to help, you know, identify how the extra money for poverty is being used. So you're saying in schools or in school districts, there are certain people making decisions have that data.
And I'm speaking now, co-chairs and Rep. Wisdom, mostly speaking about Eugene School District as an example. So what we had was access to it was food service. We had the person in charge of our database who held that, who obviously had access, and we had all the passwords to that as well. And then there was, in the Eugene District, like others, we were looking at particular investments with regard to individual buildings.
That's what we're looking for.
And the question was, for instance, in placing an after-school program, where would be the best place to put it? And what are the filters we use to decide what's the best place to put it? And there's a myriad of them, one of which had to do with our best estimates of how many students were on free and reduced lunch, because one of the elements of the after-school program is a meal or a snack after school. I believe that was just used in aggregated form, but I also know specifically the principals in schools like that wanted that kind of data, and we did not allow it, because it would be too easy for it to be printed off and maybe accidentally divulged.
Thank you. And just a following ending comment, Mr. Chair. I think as a responsible principal, supervisor, part of the system, you just said you put the facility where that population is. You also can then look at that population to do after-school programs, to do summer programs and things like that to look after this, to help this population. So that data is available for for the decision makers in the school, at least the school district.
Co-chairs and Rep. Wisnant, I want to be sure I'm very precise about this. The district does have it. There's significant restrictions about its use.
Yeah, okay,
in Eugene, we did not share that with the individual buildings, despite strong interest on the part of the principals. And we tried to use the data in the way that was most careful in terms of revealing who it was, but that would allow us to make good decisions. And just one more follow-up. As a former principal, I would have liked to know particularly who in my school, and I was at the highest poverty high school in our city, I really wanted to know which students. But I understood that knowing that was problematic. But there's ways to provide a program anyway and attract students to it. So building principals find a way to provide this kind of services, but it's deemed too risky to allow that to teachers and individual principals, at least in Eugene.
Thank you very much for your response.
If I may, I'm sorry, I beg the indulgence of the chairs. When Dr. Paul Ritzer, who was the champion for the P20 system in Oklahoma, he was a former educator here in Oregon. One of the things he identified that was a core problem was the transitory nature of students that was rising in Oklahoma. It was not uncommon for a student to move several times for a variety of reasons, and the kind of student and the socioeconomic status of those students that tend to be more transitory makes it more difficult to understand the effect of policy on because it does vary, and it skews that. And it was very hard to assemble those records for us in Oklahoma. Our P20 system aided that and identified those students it helped us to surface problems that and to address a problem that was unique to these more transitory students. And I'm sorry to interrupt you, but
thank you. It's real. Appreciate coming.
So another question is, how are institutions and regions progressing with respect to the Achievement Compact metrics? It's the Senate Bill 215 does designate for the OEIB, and there's other legislation that's come up that we're not going to have, likely not have Achievement Compacts moving forward. But the metrics have been affirmed, and not only at that committee, but throughout the state, as being critical things to watch. It's critical to watch kindergarten assessment. It's critical to watch developmental education and community college. It's critical to watch how many bachelor's degrees we're giving to Oregon students, and so on. However, we don't necessarily at this point have the ability to track that data for individual students through the pathway. So, for instance, we believe that, because this is what national data show, that kindergarten readiness affects college completion. It's a really powerful set of studies in our country, especially in Illinois, but in other places. Matter of fact, kindergarten readiness appears to have more of an effect on lifelong things like college completion than it does on third grade reading, believe it or not. And it's about, when you look under the surface, it's because a lot of the things that you learn in kindergarten, as they say, are those life lessons that go on forever. And at third grade, they don't play out as being important, like grit, perseverance, teamwork, and things, sharing. Those things don't play out as much in third grade as they do when you're 22. That kind of data, those kinds of answers, are just emerging in a few places around the country that have data systems like we're working to build. And we believe, and I've heard this not only from Oregon research like Echo Northwest and Education Northwest, but others, that a lot of the country, a lot of the United States is basing policy around one or two state longitudinal data systems in places like Illinois, Chicago in particular. And we believe that what we're seeing in some of the bigger states and cities probably plays out exactly the same way in Oregon or close to the same way. But obviously, there's going to be unique characteristics of our state and unique ways that these different metrics correlate to each other because we're different than Illinois is. And until we actually have this, we're going to be, again, to your question, Rep. Wisnant, in terms of data that we're looking at and purpose of this, we're going to be looking not only at old data, but old data from Midwest and East Coast states until we have systems like this in place. Another question, and I referred to this before, but it's worth its own slide. How do things far downstream affect the P-20 curriculum? Like Head Start. The common operating wisdom was that Head Start, which is pre-kindergarten education, doesn't make a big difference. In fact, when you look way downstream, it does. I predict, just from some initial data from other states, again, Chicago comes up, ninth grade on track is a huge predictor of things like developmental ed and degree attainment. So that's a real important focus area. As a former middle school principal, I'd be very interested, and I hope we can show this in Oregon, the effect of some middle school success. A lot of kids in middle school stop seeing the relevance of their curriculum and start thinking about 84 degree May days outside, and they are not able to. Alex had let me know that he's got a family issue to needs to take care of, so he needs to get up. So another question that the SLDS can answer. And again, just to Rep. Wisnant's question, this is it's kind of a long-term modeling of how these things affect each other, which is the purpose of this data system. What programs are successful? Yes.
I'm glad you mentioned Head Start. Again, Representative Gagas and I have talked about, I don't know the curriculum. My sister actually just retired as a Head Start county leader. But I think that Head Start also should have ELL and part of their curriculum. Is any work being done on that, or do you aware of anything in Head Start? Do they do ELL learning?
Co-chairs, Rep. Wisnant, I don't know. It's something I can find out. It's a perfect example. Let's say we invested in that. You know, $50 million, $10 million, $5 million, how do we know what effect was? And our belief is, and what we've seen in special education in terms of early identification, is really interesting data. In K-12, we over-identify students of color. In pre-K, we under-identify certain students of color. So the dynamic that we're looking at, and this with Oregon data, it looks like early identification of students allows them to get the services they need pre-K, and so when they enter the K-12 system, they get out of special education. If you don't identify students early, it looks like you identify them later, where it's harder to intervene. And I would hypothesize that the same might be true with ELL. Earlier service makes a bigger difference. So if that were to go forward, it would be interesting to track it and show it, see if it's different by language group and the like. So we can't, I don't know if we have a program, and if we did right now, we couldn't track it. So this would be a reason to do it. Thank you for the question.
Thank you. Another question?
I do have a question. I never quite figured out when to fit it into the dialogue.
No problem.
We have a bill that's kind of circulating around the building that allows students to opt out of the standard test. I'm assuming that data would go into the ODE database, which feeds this system. So if you have students opting out to a high degree, how does that impact the system?
Thank you for the question, co-chairs and Rep. Reardon. You're exactly correct that one of the major elements we collect on students is the end-of-year standardized test, which for years in Oregon has been OAKS, and this year is going to be Smarter Balanced. And the effect of a small number of students opting out is pretty minimal, and I think if this bill leads to higher percentage, it's definitely going to affect the quality of the data. I think one challenge, if that moves forward, is what are the other assessments that we use, which we believe are very valid and reliable, which are something that we would include in the mix. And if I could take just a second to say something about that, the OEIB has been involved with other agencies and other players in Oregon about assessment. And one thing that we are showing conclusively in the work that we're doing is that there are a lot of assessments out there that are currently given in schools that are of tremendous value that we don't capture in any way. We don't capture it necessarily for teacher evaluation, district evaluation, building evaluation, or for work like this. Just as an example, I was a biology teacher. I taught AP biology. AP is a well-understood curriculum, a well-understood test, a well-understood measure, as is things like SAT and others. As a biology teacher, I taught ninth grade biology. In the school that I worked, all of the biology teachers gave the same test four times a year. It allowed us to kind of calibrate each other's instruction. Things like that go on across Oregon, and I think we often default to the easiest answer, which is a statewide standardized test. And now if we don't get that data because of opt-out, we're going to be lacking. So I'm not in a position to render a judgment about opt-out, but I do think it challenges our system to look at all of the other assessments that we do that teachers have a tremendous amount of buy-in with and see whether or not we can capture some of that data. And actually, that's a perfect feed into this slide. What programs are most successful? Now we're getting really detailed. We're not talking about SBAC, which is a high-level end-of-the-year question. We're talking about things that are richly tied into the curriculum, like career and technical ed. The high school that I worked at, we had welding, we had woodshop, we had culinary arts, we had ceramics, we had art, we had photography.
God bless you.
And what we knew is that those kids stayed in school more frequently. We had data that showed it. We also knew that those teachers were gold in terms of providing a place for many of our more marginalized students to hang out after school and at lunch. What we didn't know, but what we believed, was that those students' life outcomes were better because they were in CTE. And so every year when funding cuts came in at North Eugene High School, we protected those programs. And they're spendy, so it's hard to do that. When the tendency would be, like when our OAKS scores fell or our Smarter Balance scores fell, the tendency would be to bring in a second dose of math. We keep them. But what we can't prove today and what we'd like to prove tomorrow is what happens with students who learn woodshop. What careers do they go into? How long do they persist? What jobs are they able to get? And that allows policymakers at your level to make investments in CTE, STEM, or others that maybe you wouldn't ordinarily make, but now you can show your return on investment. It also would help an agency. It also would help a district. So this is a huge one, obviously, for us. And then the final slide, and then we can take more questions. Maybe I'll show one or two more. But what student achievements are critical to lifelong success? One big one that we've seen already this year that the Oregon Department of Education has taught us by using their longitudinal database, because they have one. Brian Reeder over at ODE mm-hmm. has a longitudinal database that goes K through 12, is that bilingualism helps students do better in school. And where we see that most clearly is when students graduate out of an ELL program, particularly if they graduate before ninth grade, they graduate at higher levels than students with one language, even if English is their native language. And really, the only way to interpret that is that there's a benefit from knowing two languages. And that's what a lot of the research show for students who learn two languages at birth, simultaneously bilingual kids. There's some interesting research on that. But the EOL research is really new. And I think Oregon's research is a leader in that area. We could show that even farther down the line. In Eugene and in lots of other districts, there's dual immersion. What I know is that Eugene has French, Spanish, and Japanese. And there's a lot of discussion about Mandarin, but they haven't done it yet. Some districts have done that, and there's even other languages. How do you justify that cost in your community? One way you do it is you show these long-term effects on outcomes that we really value as a community that affect our prosperity or the accomplishments of our children. So that this is the kind of thing, again, that a student-level longitudinal database will show.
Here.
So how do you know that it isn't just all the smart kids taking, learning two languages? I mean, the smarter kids, can you really compare to their ability level or IQ, if you will?
Co-chairs.
Really making a difference?
Co-chairs and Representative Reardon, you absolutely can. Okay. And what you do, it's a statistical technique. There's a number of them, but the general technique is called regression or multiple regression. And what it means is you can take a look at a bunch of variables, and you can control for certain variables to examine the effect of others. So, for example, we give kids OAKS. We take it's not an IQ test, but it is an achievement test. And we can categorize all the kids that score about the same in language arts and math, and have them as a specific group. And then in that group, look at kids who got a biliterate certificate on their diploma and the ones that don't, and compare outcomes. It's super powerful. And you can do that with all kinds of demographic characteristics like gender and race, and all kinds of achievement characteristics. And you end up finding stuff that's really interesting. One other thing I'll just share as a school person, some analysis of data show that this is something that someone in our office, Angela Bloom, is my executive assistant, found out as part of our database research. Creative writing classes lead to high math achievement. That's not the kind of thing you just kind of figure out waking up in the morning as a teacher or a principal. You only find that by doing this kind of statistical analysis and start eliminating things, and you look and you find, what the heck is this variable doing? It is showing a high effect on what you're studying. So this is exactly the kind of purpose, and again, back to Rep. Wisnant's question, this higher level, this diving into data, big data, that we'll be able to do on Oregon education that we currently are not able to do. The only other thing I'll say from the presentation, just so you can navigate it, in the middle, I put evidence from our other partners, so ODE, OUS, CCWD, and the Employment Department, about how they're currently using longitudinal data. The reason I did that is I want to outline the existing wonderful work of partners out there in our state and underline the fact that there's nothing new under the sun. Longitudinal data systems are not new. What OEIB is working on is not necessarily new. The breadth of it is wider than what's been done in Oregon, but this work is currently underway. And again, finally, back to Rep. Wisnant's question, some of this is going on right now at ODE and is providing real-time data. ODE has identified priority and focus districts. They're getting them real-time data in terms of student achievement. So at the agency level, that happens more at the real-time. This is more of the longer look that you folks need and agency leaders need to make policy decisions. And with that, I'll stop talking questions.
We do have some questions. Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Vice Chair Gallegos. Mr. Trauma, thank you for being here today. This is... I find it fascinating information. I delved in this world in a former life for a period of time, and when we look at longitudinal data and things out quite a ways, one of the opportunities that we tapped into in my local high school when I was involved locally, and then at the Oregon, well, it's now the Office of Student Access and Completion. Right. The acronym changes over time. I think I got that one right. was how you follow a student once they either leave high school or leave our university system here in Oregon. How do you follow them? And we took advantage of the National Student Clearinghouse. We bought licenses for our local high school. We did it at OSAC because we needed that information. It goes out years and years and years, and you can actually find out where people end up and what they do. And I've been interested in trying to find out if it's worth the state's while to just buy a state blanket license so our high schools and our colleges can actually find what these completion rates are in an accurate way across the nation. And has anybody ever looked into just buying a license for the clearinghouse?
Co-chairs and Rep. McEwen, the answer is they have, and they've done that. So, and if ODE is watching me right now and this is no longer true, I'll make sure to correct it. But I know when I worked in Eugene just 2 years ago that the ODE had purchased National Student Clearinghouse data, and where districts were capable of taking that in, they're able to add it to their local data warehouse or their data system and have that available for their high schools and their district to follow outcomes.
That's really good to know.
Yeah.
So now local high schools and local community colleges and colleges do not have to purchase it. We have a blanket license for the state.
That is my understanding. My commitment
Fantastic.
To the committee is if that's not true or it's changed, I'll make sure the committee administrator gets that email and maybe some explanation for why.
Great.
Now, one follow-up might be, well, if we have a national organization that already helps track longitudinal outcomes, why do we need this? And there's really a couple of answers to it. One is that we do not have visibility into the National Student Clearinghouse and their matching. And there's a lot of questions, especially at higher ed, about the data and what it shows regarding Oregon students into higher ed. And enough questions about that where the higher ed level, at both at CCWD and at OUS, they have a high interest in having some other way of measuring this where they can actually see into the data to confirm the match rates that we're seeing. Second, the National Student Clearinghouse doesn't have this element of workforce to it, and being able to follow kids to that next step is so important for our economic investment that we judge it to be of high priority. Nevertheless, we are a partner with the National Student Clearinghouse as a state in a couple of different ways and value that data. And like I said, if that's not something that's available, I'll let you know. I do know that one limit in districts is their capacity to use that data meaningfully back with the high school to give feedback, just to have somebody like me or somebody like that who can present back at the district level. Sometimes just because of staffing, they might not have a data person on staff to make heads or tails of all that. So some of that data languishes for lack of enough folks to explain it.
And that may be an opportunity to train local high school staff and provide them whatever that they're going to need to make that successful. Because if we are trying to meet that 40-40-20 benchmark, and we can follow those students out 6, 7, 8, 9 years and find out that they did complete someplace out of state at whatever level they completed, it's going to help us. I just think it's really important information to have, and it's a potentially a great tool for us. So thank you.
Co-chairs, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Gayoaks. Kind of maybe a step the other way or some simpler data, and I want to get your response on this. Oregon now is known for the lowest graduation rates, and we also have an average student-teacher ratio of a little over 21. If you look at the top 20 K through 12 schools, their average is 14 ratio of 14 students per one teacher. How does that play into the data? I hear we're collecting a lot of data and talking about higher education, looking at the successes, but if we step back to some more simple ratios of how many teachers per student we have, it seems to be a pretty strong correlation to lowering that ratio. You get higher graduation and higher success to give you a better base to go on to that. I wonder if you could respond to that.
Sure. Co-chairs and Representative Hayden. So a couple things in that to unpack. One thing just to share, and this is pretty complex topic, graduation rates, but something that I know our organization, ODE, have started to look at. States do define graduation a little bit differently. So in terms of Oregon's exact place, I think Smarter Balanced might be a better way to do some apples-to-apples comparisons, and really excited to see what that show. But nevertheless, if we're not last, we're not where we need to be, no doubt about that. The question of class size is an interesting one. Data show generally that class size only matters in particular situations. It does have an effect, but its most pronounced effect is particular things. One is very, very low classes for particular students can show a huge effect. So where you have students that need some intensive interventions or something like that, 14, 4, 2 or something like that, intense work with students can make just an absolutely huge effect. Then among a range of numbers, in the 20s to 30s or something like that, there's not good data to show that one more student makes a big difference until you get past some critical point where it's kind of just chaos in the classroom. So it's not entirely straightforward where the cutoffs are. It's different depending on the needs of the student. It's also different depending on the age of the student. I'll give you one example about how this plays out. Where I was a middle school principal, we intentionally created algebra classes of over 40 so that our pre-algebra retake class for students that had failed pre-al the first time could be under 20. So it was a strategic way to create small and big in different places. But I do think one element of the longitudinal data system that I'm very interested in looking at are these downstream effects of really large classes and downstream effects of really small classes. Because I know as a teacher, there's a difference between 30 and 45. And although you might be able to be a really great stage manager with 45, there are gaps that occur there that might not play out that first year, but probably will play out over time. So I don't mean to exactly, I'm not trying to side skirt the question. There's not a one-to-one relationship between class size and achievement. It's more nuanced, but it does have a very important effect in certain cases with certain students.
Thank you.
And certain ages.
Just a short follow-up.
The data I have, maybe it's incorrect, but there's only three states that have a student-teacher ratio of over 20, and those three states are in the bottom third. So I'm not sure where the 30-40 comes in. The highest is 25.
Co-chairs and Rep. Hayden, I was you're talking about averages, and I was just giving examples of some of the range. I think data may be a little bit lacking in this answer, but as a practitioner who actually was in a classroom, having more students affects the quality of what I and others have been able to do. There's no question. Where exactly that cutoff is scientifically, so that I could give you a number, is a little bit of a different answer than if I had to come up as a teacher to this committee and saying what I've seen in my career is this, and the answer would have been a little bit more black and white.
Thank you, Mr. Trumbo. I have some questions too, but I really would like to hear from Mr. Pettit since he's good enough to come back.
Yes, sir. So. Again, my name is Alex Pettit. Our engagement with specifically with the OEIB and the project that they've been doing has been with managing or helping them manage the process for the for how to get through the project and project stage gate process. And so our desire has been to, and as a consequence of that, as Peter had said, there were a number of changes that have happened to the project as it evolved over time. Some of the scope things have narrowed, some of the focuses have narrowed, and overall we've got a project that's lighter weight, that's simplified, let's say greatly simplified over where we were, and really should provide a lot of information, be able to inform a lot of things, particularly those things that are inter-district or moving between different levels of education. So we do support the project. We support the project both in its concept, having had the experience of working with Dr. Rizzer in Oklahoma on a similar project. Well, same project, really. It was a little, ours was more real-time in Oklahoma. We were actually able every day to get at 10 a.m. And we were working with the raw data rather than an extract or a warehouse of the data. So it was a different type of project, but we were fortunate to start from a different place than we are here. So I'm happy to answer any questions, though, of the committee.
Representative.
Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a little question for Mr. Trumba. Who gets access to the data? So, for instance, does a researcher at a university get access to it? Can someone out of state get access to it? Can the legislature have access to it? Can just a citizen have access to it? Can you talk to that?
Co-chairs and Representative Nierman, the vision is that it would be a public access site like the existing ODE site and others, maybe like the 10-year plan site, with a couple of limitations. So I mentioned before that all the personally identifiable information would be removed, and that specifically is to allow you, your staff, a citizen, a mayor to look what's going on in my district or my city or my county or whatever. However, you won't be able to do a search that results in a answer that's derived from just a few students, because if you wanted to search really, really particular thing, you could get down to one kid, and that would make it personally identifiable. And that's how the Oregon Department of Education works. If you try to search and it responds to something lower than five or lower than six kids, it says not available. And our system will do the same thing. But the idea would be that it's anybody can use it. Now, with respect to researchers, what currently happens, because we do as a state work with universities to forward knowledge about our system, and we, and not OEIB, but like the Oregon Department of Education, works with researchers and they sign memorandums of agreement. And those researchers agree to destroy the data after it's been used. And they do, because they have the individual student-level data, have the ability of figuring out an individual student. But that's not publicly released. It's just for the purposes of research under very strict conditions.
One little question. I'm not wanting to throw scope creep in there, but it occurred to me that maybe the next piece of data that you need in there is the Department of Corrections, maybe for another year or something like that. But thanks for your presentation.
Representative Reardon.
Well, this is great stuff. I was just curious, the courses offered at some of them at high schools and certainly at the different universities are not totally standardized. Does that affect your ability to do research?
Co-chairs and Representative Reardon, absolutely. So one of the questions you're going to have to ask, let's say you wanted to reference, a big one for me is Algebra 2. Like, do you really need to take Algebra 2 in high school to be successful in life? I love math. I took calculus as a junior. Great, great, great. Try to teach Algebra 2 to every kid at a high school. It's really, really difficult. It's a graduation requirement. One question is, do we need it? So you'd want to be able to analyze Algebra 2 passers, Algebra 2 who failed, and what was their performance. And then you're immediately going to get to, if you're a researcher, are these all the same Algebra 2s? And unfortunately, they're not. So you have to account as a researcher for the variance in that. Nevertheless, I'm also a huge favorite, and this goes back to the question about smarter balanced and opt out. I'm a big favorite of having assessments like Algebra 2 tests be more common across the state, chemistry tests in ninth grade English or whatever, for a couple reasons. One is maybe that's more valuable than smarter balanced, but also because driving towards more commonality in some ways allows us to do these comparisons. So I'm a big fan. We're not ever going to move in lockstep, but more alignment is better.
I have a question. I'm curious about common perception seems to be out there that the education budget is solely for teacher FTE, and there's little recognition that it really is a lot of other things. And one thing that Representative Wisnett and I have been talking about is the reporting processes out there and the number of various reports. You've got federal reports, Title I reports, you've got foundation money reports, and so on. is there a way to consolidate all of that reporting? Because it takes administrators' time, it takes teachers' time, and I think time is money in this case. So how is there a way we can begin to think about consolidating the kind of data we need and the reporting process? I mean, do you think this system is going to help us with that? I guess that's what I'm getting at.
Co-chairs and Representative Gallegos, great question. It's not part of this project. It is part of the work currently underway at the ODE, and I believe it's in the vision of a higher education coordinating commission data system, part of the vision there. And the idea is to provide a service to districts through their data collection, where they do that more of that real-time collection, but at ODE, not OEIB, and they produce some of those reports to try to take that burden, especially off of smaller districts. Because if you can get a grant that gives your district $1 million, but in order to actually meet all the needs of it, it costs hundreds of thousands and a lot of distraction, is it really worth it? And at some level, that is so counterproductive that districts don't apply.
Exactly.
The thing that districts have to give up if they want to do that is that they have to share more of their data, and some are reticent to do that. So there's a give and take. And actually, Alex was kind enough to go to a meeting of district IT directors about 6 weeks ago. Then there's a whole group that's led by the CIO of the Oregon Department of Education, Ben Tate, to do that exact kind of data gathering, and that's one of the main purposes.
To follow up to Peter's answer, it would require the districts to move what's called the system of record. So right now the systems of record exist in the school districts themselves. In Oklahoma, we had 455 school districts. I don't know how many we have here in Oregon.
197.
So those systems of record are where these reports have to come from. For someone to provide it, it would mean that a transfer of that system of record, of the authentic place of the source of the true information, would have to be agreed upon, and the sovereignty of that data would have to be set before a service like that could be provided. We were fortunate that we could do that in my previous state. It's not clear to me if that's of interest to the state of Oregon or not.
Follow-up question that I have also, and it kind of has to do with data collection as well. I mean, I can see where K-12 or community college or even the university system, you know, we've got sort of a captive sample there. But I can't imagine what we'd run into in terms of the workforce piece. How do we begin to track workforce?
Sure. Co-chairs and Representative Gallegos, a really fascinating question. And we do it right now. And there's great data out that I just saw in a HEC office that was showing degrees and a number of years down the road how many are employed and what they're making. I don't know if this committee has seen that yet or if it's just early information, but really interesting what degrees are leading to what outcomes. So the Oregon Employment Department has a database that they share with Community College Workforce Development and OUS and link on students. And all that's in that workforce database is Social Security number, wages, amount of, I think it's days worked in the month, and then a sector code about what type of industry the work is in. So if the person worked in a hospital, it would show that they worked in a hospital. It wouldn't show if they were a doctor or a nurse or somewhere at the front desk, but it would show where they worked, show how much they made, and show a rough idea of how many hours they worked. And by reasoning with just that information, you're able to back map that to careers. The tricky thing, you may guess, is Social Security number. We don't collect that in K-12. We're actually one of the few states our decision at our state is that we don't collect that. Other states do collect it, and it enables them to follow K-12 students into the workforce. In Oregon, we only capture that data when a student applies for a scholarship or when they enroll at community college or university. And then we've captured it, and then we can follow it into the workforce. And that kind of linking has been going on for years, and OED, Oregon Employment Department, is a wonderful partner with higher ed, and I assume will continue to be in the future.
I guess just one follow-up. Peter, thanks for being here. You know, one of the frustrations with the OEIB, I think, has been the lack of the availability of good data to drive the investment, if you will, recommendations that the OEIB was tasked with providing to this body and to ODE and to the HEC and so forth. So, i.e., are we going to get to the point where we can learn, okay, if we've got a third-grade class in Umatilla where 90% of our Latino students are exceeding benchmarks in reading, we can understand and board, look at what practices was that classroom teacher using, what were the ratios of teachers to students, what are all the surrounding circumstances that it's allowing that success to happen, so that we can then replicate that to the same kind of demographic classroom in Salem-Keizer or Roseburg or Medford. When will we be at that point so that we can, again, make informed decisions about how we're going to invest in the policies that we're going to create as a body here?
Co-chairs and Representative Johnson, great question. And one thing I want to note that happened concurrent with OEIB's formation was there was a recognition that as a state we also had to invest in research. So that led to ODE hiring two researchers. They'd had Brian Reeder only for that whole organization in a whole state. And he's been able to add two researchers, and we were able to add two researchers. Because the truth is, this is more of a problem of not having enough researchers to look at the data than a lack of data on Umatilla. Because ODE has the data on every classroom, student performance, whether they're ELL, right now. And so it's more what are the questions that we need to ask, and then how do we translate the answers that we get into actionable policy recommendations. And I'll speak from an individual's point of view, who I did a lot of work a number of months ago in terms of analyzing recommended budget expenditures. And I hear from others involved in the system that this was a first, and I know this maybe is a fail on OEIB's part, but there were successes there too. Every one of the ODE investments was based on data that came out of either Brian Reeder's shop or someone associated with ODE. And like or not like the ELL funding formula recommendation, the CTE funding formula recommendation, the ninth grade on track funding formula recommendation, age 3 to grade 3 or what have you, every single one of those was based in research in Oregon. And maybe it wasn't the right policy or the right time for that policy, but I think, and I've heard this, I'm fairly new up here, so I don't know that this is entirely true, but it was one of the first times that those recommendations were based on hard data rather than maybe what was heard at a conference or what was reckoned to be true just based on kind of seat-of-the-pants reasoning. There was data that showed ELL success by ninth grade mattered, and that's why there was an ELL investment, and that's why there's one going forward, right? It's not exactly the same one that was originally proposed, but it's there. Same with CTE and same with the other one. So I guess what I can't emphasize enough is with the amount of money that we spend on education, we have to think about the amount of research and thought that goes into the coherent spending of that and attend to what we can learn from the research to make better investments. But it's maybe less about this and more about you folks inquiring of people like me, why do you want to do that investment? What data backs it up? And if we have it, that might be new phenomena. I don't know if that got your answer, but that's...
Yeah. Okay. Other questions? I think that's it then. Thank you so much.
Really thank you very much.
Thank you. With that, we'll close the informational hearing.
We do have a Friday meeting.
We do have a Friday meeting.
We do have a Friday meeting.
8:30.
We'll
be hearing from some of the incoming student government representatives.
Are we ever going to get to meet the new University of Oregon president, too? Was he going to come?
When we asked, he was not available yet.
Oh, okay.
So probably during one of our...
Just wondered if the last.
Not available.